When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Before you begin listening to this episode, please be aware that the topics discussed on this podcast may be triggering for those following the news story around the disappearance of Sarah Everard last week. Hi, I'm Francesca Spector, and you're listening to Alone Month, the podcast that broadens the conversation around alone time. Each episode, I ask my guest about the time they spend by themselves and why it matters. At the heart of every episode is one central question. What turns solitude into a good or bad experience? Because when alone time isn't lonely, it's alonement. My guest this week is poet Holly McNish. Holly has been described by critics as a bewildering law unto herself. And you know what? That's pretty accurate. Forget everything you thought you knew about poetry. Holly, who formerly went by the pseudonym Holly Poetry, is a far cry from the poets you learnt about for your GCSE coursework. She writes her poetry in the notes section of her iPhone, is unafraid to cover topics that others shy away from masturbation to breastfeeding, and was the first poet to record a spoken word album at the famous Abbey Road Studios in London. This is one of my favourite episodes I've done for the podcast so far, and I hope you get a lot from listening to this episode.
I really like being on my own. I'm on my own a lot, like my whole, I don't have colleagues, haven't had colleagues for years, really. Not colleagues that you go into an office and like see every day. So I'm on my own a lot for my job and then for touring. I'm on my own a lot. Obviously live with a kid, so I don't always chat to like an adult at night and stuff. But yeah, then sometimes times that I would really like to enjoy being alone, I just feel scared, which pisses me off quite a lot. But then actually I went for a walk the other day around the city and got like shouted at by this bloke, and then it got a bit dark. And then I was like, oh, if I felt safe, I'd love to be alone a lot more. And I love being outside and looking at the stars. But if I go and do that on my own, which I'd like to, I then feel quite scared that someone's going to murder me.
I recorded this podcast episode with Holly at the beginning of the year. And it's harrowing to listen back after the tragic news story around the disappearance of Sarah Everard this week, which has given our conversation an eerie resonance. So much of mine and Holly's conversation is focused around fear, the fear of being physically alone as a woman. When we were recording, it struck me how much we both just accept on a day-to-day basis the experiences that we share. For instance, Holly speaks about being too scared to go for walks near where she lives, so she cycles so she can at least outrun anyone who might chase her. To think that we just swallow that on a daily basis is pretty sickening. I thought a lot about whether to share this episode in its entirety or not. I worried that it might prove triggering to some people, which is why I've included a warning at the beginning. At points during this podcast, both me and Holly play down the very real, very valid fears that we express, And given the events of the past couple of weeks, I thought it was important to share this. It's not right how we're discussing it, but it's an honest reflection of how much we as women have just internalized these fears and inhibitions for so long, and that needs to change. Sarah Everard disappeared after she walked home through Clapham at 9:30 on the 3rd of March 2021. At time of writing, it has been confirmed that human remains were found in woodland in Kent, while a serving Met police officer in his 40s has been arrested on suspicion of murder. Sarah's disappearance shows that even taking all the safety precautions we're told we should as women, including calling a partner on the way home and walking along a main road, even when doing all that, the worst can still happen. This horrific story has led to women sharing their experiences privately and on social media about the baseline of fear that we live with and the constant safety precautions we take on a day-to-day basis, even in a seemingly progressive country like the UK. Running through this podcast episode is a very serious discussion about the implications of being physically alone as a woman. I hope this episode makes you think.
Hiya, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, absolutely great.
Oh, wicked. All right, perfect. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good. All right. Managed to get my daughter to talk a little bit more quietly.
Oh, bless her. Bless her. Did you have to bribe her?
No, she's all right. I've given her potato waffles for breakfast. I think that was like enough bribery.
Yeah, I think that was for me as well. Excellent bribery tactic. To start off with, let's talk more broadly. How has your alone time played out recently? I know you've probably been homeschooling.
Yeah, I have been homeschooling. It's all right, to be honest. I still get quite a lot of time by myself, which I think a lot of parents especially are not at the moment, but that's mainly because I co-parent and don't live with my daughter's partner. So I think actually I get sort of three evenings a week to myself still. I've only got one child and she's at her dad's 3 evenings a week. So that is my current alone time. But unfortunately, it's mainly the time that I catch up on my job. So basically, I think my alone time at the moment is sort of between 4 to 6 when my daughter's on Roblox with her friends. That's it. So it's not alone, but it's still no one like wants me.
Yeah.
And there's video games around.
Those blissful 2 hours. It's, you know, it's so funny. I was listening to Helena Bonham Carter on Louis Theroux's Grounded podcast, and she was talking about co-parenting in the same way. She was saying, you know, she gets those periods of time alone.
Yeah. And you get periods of time where no one knows where you are. And where you can actually just leave the house without like giving a reason. It is pretty amazing. Like that side of it, there's obviously like downsides, but that side of living on your own with a kid is pretty good if you co-parent. I imagine if you're like a single parent, it is the opposite, because on the days when I'm with my daughter, obviously I actually physically can't really leave the house without her. So it's the opposite. So I guess, yeah, more intense on the day she's here, and then you get some... Yeah, time. Yeah, it's weird to have total freedom when you can just go out for a walk if you want and no one asks where you're going to be or how long you're going to be or why or if there's a problem.
That's funny. Yeah, because I imagine normally as a parent, there's maybe, you know, that tension when there's one parent that your child always goes to when there's a problem, for instance.
That is so true. And also a lot of I genuinely don't know what it's like for most of the dads, because it's the mums that I talk to about it. But most of them say that at weekends, even if it's like both parents, neither of them really get any time alone, because you're still both kind of on duty. You don't sort of say, right, today's your day, tomorrow's my day sort of thing. Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, just seeing families walking past my window on walks. And I've got to say, where there's two parents and kids, they look the most annoyed.
a parent on their own, they sort of look overjoyed, or a parent with one kid, or seems to be quite a difference.
That's so funny.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have thought about it like that, but yeah, of course, it's kind of like, yeah, you're in either in the mum zone or you're not.
Yeah, and you can actually go, and I guess it's always a bit half and half, isn't it, when your kid's still there? But I snuck off yesterday at lunchtime. She was having a Zoom, and I was like, it's my lunch break, I'm gonna have a bath. There's got to be some like upsides of all this rubbish. So I sort of snuck into the bath for an hour until she caught me. But that sort of thing, I don't know if I'd have done with another adult in the house, because I think I would have felt too guilty to look like I was relaxing too much if I had a partner that was like working, or even maybe a flatmate, I'm not sure. But yeah, if it's just a kid that catches me, I'm much less frightened.
You're like, hey, I'm here, I'm in the bath, I'm owning it.
Yeah, she's like, oh my god, you're having a bath. And I was like, oh, you're playing with your mates. Yeah, I'm in the bath.
Oh god, I mean, I'm a long way off parenthood, but you know, I hear these stories of, you know, especially like new parents finding it hard to even like go to the loo by themselves or have a shower.
Yeah, that time's over for me now. It's much easier with, I've only got one kid, so I really, and as I said, I get a couple of days on my own, but yeah, 10-year-olds are all right.
Knows how to plug into Zoom by this point.
Yeah, and it knows how to set up a conference call and let me have a bath. It's all good.
Great. Wow. So she's tech support as well.
I think that's the positive of all this stuff, thinking your kid's getting too much screen time, but actually they're just going to be like computer wizards. Yeah. That's what I'm saying to myself anyway.
Broadly, when I say the words alone, what do you think of first?
I think the first thing that I think of is space. So I was thinking about this a lot, just space to be on your own. Like, I think of it positively when I think of it first. Alone is like really special as well. But then as soon as I started thinking about that, I also sort of started thinking about danger. So I guess it's those two things. Like, I really like being on my own. I'm on my own a lot, like my whole, I don't have colleagues, haven't had colleagues for years, really. Not colleagues that you go into an office and like see every day. So I'm on my own a lot for my job, and then for touring, I'm on my own a lot. Obviously live with the kids, so I don't always chat to like an adult at night and stuff. But yeah, then sometimes, times that I would really like to enjoy being alone, I just feel scared, which pisses me off quite a lot. So if I think, being in cafes, I think I missed that a lot with lockdown. Just nobody knowing who you are, like genuinely, like that much alone, that you're like a stranger to everybody and you can just sort of people watch and people don't know you. I love that. But then actually I went for a walk the other day around the city and got like shouted at by this bloke, and then it got a bit dark. And then I was like, oh, if I felt safe, I'd love to be alone a lot more. And I love being outside and looking at the stars, but if I go and do that on my own, which I'd like to, I then feel quite scared that someone's going to murder me, basically.
I mean,
that's what I'm saying. It's
annoying. It's, you know, such to be a woman. And that's so interesting that it sort of coexists, that sense of space and fear. It makes me think when I go to visit my parents, because I'm bubbling with them at the moment, there's some woods near their house, and it's honestly the most blissful thing to go for a walk through those woods by myself, except I tend to time it at, I sort of walk a few meters into these woods and I sort of look around and see if there's any sort of groups of people. And I tend to time it at busier times when they'll be around. And I completely get that difficulty of not being able to be alone in a way that feels secure.
Yeah, it's so annoying. And that's, I think, like, I ask my partner quite a lot if he'll just come and stand outside with me when he's visiting, because I just want to stand in like this bit down the road and look at the stars. It's so like rural where I live, but I just won't do it on my own. But I think also it's been spoiled for me. Like, a few times I've had really horrible experiences, like never actually anyone physically touched me, but I had a great idea a couple of years ago to go to, like, a forest near us, but it's like a a park forest. So there's like a cafe in it. It's not huge or anything. It's not really, really outfit. And I took my book and I took my pen and paper and I thought, right, this is amazing, actually. I need to, you know, make the most of living in a really boring village and go and work from there while my daughter's at school. And so I went into a slightly less populated area of this country park. And after about half an hour of feeling like, oh, this is blissful, so nice and quiet, this weird guy came over and started circling me, telling me it was his birthday, asking me to stroke his head. Like, really, it was really intimidating. And that's happened, that sort of thing has happened, I'd say about five times in different settings where I've thought, I'll sit on this park, you know, on this bench or whatever. And then a guy came on his bike and then just cycled back and then just stood in front of the bench, just staring at me, not saying anything. It's really weird. Yeah. So I think it's been spoiled quite a lot for me. So now I always take my bike and a lot of my friends sort of laugh at me because I don't really want to go walking. I don't like walking at all. I really like cycling. But I don't like walking on my own because I just feel like if I got into some sort of trouble, yeah, I just wouldn't be able to do it. So I always take my bike and then I love cycling alone. So I feel more secure moving, being alone and looking at countryside whilst I'm on a piece of equipment that could possibly outrun somebody chasing me. That's my good alone time.
Oh, that makes me so sad that that you're limited there.
It is a shame. I mean, loads of people obviously have it much worse. I'm sort of fairly young and healthy and stuff. I can't imagine what I'm going to be like when I'm elderly. I just need a chaperone to go out and do anything.
I always think about this in terms of like, in the past, obviously women weren't actually allowed to go out without chaperones, which is bonkers.
Yeah, it's bonkers. My gran said that. She used to stand outside the pub and stuff. I think that's also why it's just an extra feeling of freedom, I think, that I feel if I ever travel on my own, or which I have to do for my work a lot. But sitting on trains, places where I guess, like I say, feel pretty safe, I just find it so gorgeous, even if I'm surrounded by people.
You know, I think it was interesting what you said about working at cafes as well, that sort of feeling of being surrounded by others. It's funny, isn't it? Because it's not technically alone, and yet there's a real feeling of, I think definitely like freedom and aloneness, and it's like a celebration of your aloneness.
Yeah, it is. It's so freeing, I think, to just be by yourself in places like that. And also, I've got to say, for me, I do love seeing people, because otherwise, if I didn't do that, I would just be sitting every day working on my own, mainly, unless I rarely had a meeting. But I don't live in a city, so I don't often like meet face to face with people. But it's silly the things that I sort of miss living on my own as an adult. There are some things which are honestly just brilliant, I've got to say, which I love so much. But nobody making me a cup of tea is such a tiny thing. But I think that's one of the reasons that pulls me to a cafe. Just somebody like making me a treat. And I love it if I go to stay with my boyfriend or friends and somebody else makes you a cup of tea, which at the moment, I guess in lockdown, it's ridiculous. I'm obviously missing other things more than that. But just the joy of somebody else making you a hot drink. So I've, you know, been cycling. There's nothing where I live. So I've been cycling sort of 40 minutes to get just to take away a cup of tea before I start work sometimes, because that feels really nice. So yeah, highs and lows. But I've also been trying to train my daughter to make it. I've put it on like this very small chore list, is to get me a cup of tea on a Sunday morning.
That is amazing.
It's like, look, I'm really sorry, but this will really get me in a better mood if you just ask if I want to get a cup of tea on a Sunday.
No, it's amazing. You start small with the tea, and then, you know, she'll be a Michelin starred chef by the end of the year, hopefully. You know what? I do that quite a lot, and it's a really funny thing. Sometimes part of my routine is genuinely to go and walk to the coffee shop and to like have that social interaction, because that's enough, I feel. That's enough to almost give a flavor to your alone time and make that positive as well, I suppose, like that balance.
Yeah, I think so. It's weird, isn't it? Like,
I know a lot of people, I obviously miss my family in lockdown, but I miss my friends a bit more desperately, I think. And I didn't think I'd miss strangers, like being around strangers, but I really miss that. So yeah, even if I do go outside and walk or cycle, I always go the route that I think I'll see people. Yeah.
It's funny. So I speak about that in the book, actually. I call it conspicuous alonement. And it's so funny. But so the reason, apparently, because I found this when lockdown happened at first, because I was so used to writing in coffee shops like you. And I found it very strange, you know, why am I missing being alone around other people? Why am I missing being that sort of creep in the corner of the coffee shop watching everyone? And okay, so but there is actually, and I'm justifying us here, there is actually psychological a study behind why we like it. So this study they did where people sat, again, groups of strangers, they either ate a piece of delicious chocolate by themselves or they ate a piece of delicious chocolate in the presence of a stranger. And the people who ate the delicious chocolate in the presence of a stranger, even though they didn't speak, they enjoyed it more. And so it's something, it's amazing. It's something about shared experiences being better, even if you're sort of alone in them.
That's really amazing. It's kind of uplifting as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I love the word conspicuous as well. Also loved the word delicious when you were saying it. I've got to say, I was thinking, what if they gave it not delicious chocolate? But yeah, conspicuous. I think it must be what it is. Because I was thinking, is it because I like seeing people or I like people seeing me? And I'm sure it's a bit of both. Like after spending so much time on your own, I feel like I just wanted someone to acknowledge that I existed.
Yeah.
Even a nod as you walk past them, or yeah, I guess as well, if you've got people around you, there's like a chance, if it's in a safe environment, there's a chance that something might happen that you didn't expect or plan. Whereas if you're on your own, sort of spontaneity of sort of life onto you is a bit less, I think.
No, I think you're right. I think obviously, you know, you can create spontaneity and novelty when you're by yourself, but it's sort of it's harder. It is harder. Like there's more momentum almost when you're with other people to sort of create the outsideness.
Yeah, I guess if I'm walking around and you see obviously lots of beautiful things in nature, that does it. Like if a bird suddenly lands on the tree outside my window, I get pretty excited these days. So that's the highlight.
I totally get what you mean about nature as well, because I think it was, I mean, you know, the last time that being alone was cool was kind of in the, you know, romantic poetry era when, you know, Wordsworth would go wandering, experiencing the bliss of solitude. But that would be within nature. That would be, as you say, this spontaneity that can come from other people, that can also come from nature. And, you know, this is why walking in a forest as a woman would feel really great.
Oh, it would feel so great. It would be so good, wouldn't it? I always think that at night, like I love the nighttime. I love that like gloaming time in the evening. Just knowing that it's going to be dark soon. It's like, oh. Also, there's certain things I find it funny having, I guess being alone more than I normally am. Like I used to see a friend each day really after the school run and go to someone's house or stay for dinner or whatever quite a lot. Like don't often spend that much time alone after like school times. But I find it funny on your own how we're still so set on certain things that are like culturally acceptable to do on your own. So I've noticed I don't like walking. I don't really like walking anyway, I've got to say, but the fear thing does, you know, add to it in certain places. But I really hate running unless it's like to play football or whatever sports. I like sports, but I hate running. I'm really not a jogger. I'm never going to be a person that's going to do like a 5K or a marathon or whatever. But I find it amazing how for an adult, there's certain things it's like it's culturally acceptable to go for a run.
but like roller skating, scooting, skateboarding, it's like cycling's all right. We've got this like really thin line of what things are all right to do, especially on your own as an adult, like even in groups. I think we have to get into groups as an adult to like fight against the cultural like laughter at us, basically, to do things that you just prefer doing. So if I'm with my daughter, our daily exercise is mainly on our roller skates. So I still got some from when I was like 17, I think. And I hate walking. It's so slow. I'm short. My legs are short. I don't like running. I don't find really any pleasure in it. Maybe I haven't tried it enough, but I don't want to get like hot and sweaty. I'm not going out to do like a exercise routine. I'm just wanting, you know, to skate. But I went and dropped her off at her dad's the other day on my skates, and she was on her skates, felt totally fine, because it looks like, oh sweet, like a parent, you know, joining in with your kid. But I took shoes in my bag so that to skate back, which is about, it's like a half hour skate, it's not a lot, because I thought, oh, I can't now do this on my own to go back. What if I fall and I'm on my own? I look like a total dick. Like, and I've noticed as well, I used to like scoot to the school run with my daughter. It's like a 45 minute walk, and we always just walk or scoot or cycle. And she had a scooter, and I was so bored of doing this like adult half walk, half jog. Like, it's so boring doing the stuff that adults are allowed to do. So I bought a scooter as well. But coming, dropping her off at school and then trying to scoot back amongst loads of parents, like the jip that you get for just being on a scooter as an adult, like we're so like butthurt about what other adults do that isn't this tiny, you know, tiny, tiny acceptability. I've got a neighbor who's a bodybuilder, and so he's got to do his exercise routine. He's not in the gym, he's like does those sort of muscle competitions and stuff. And we don't have a place where he can do it really. We've got sort of shared gardens and stuff in the back, but the concrete is like a communal space, so he's like skipping there and doesn't seem to be embarrassed at all about doing it. But I guess because it's like a adult thing that he's doing it for, you know. Whereas I've just been thinking, like, God, all the things that I feel stupid doing on my own are the things that I much prefer doing.
That's interesting.
Like skates versus walking versus cycling.
And so when you drop your daughter off, you would then take separate shoes and walk home, even though you don't like walking, rather than...
I did just these once, because it's been the only time I think I've skated her to her dad's and then thought, oof, then I'll have to skate back. But in the end, she sort of took the piss out of me. And I didn't want her to think that, oh, once you get to a certain age, you then have to start being embarrassed of things that you find really fun. Like, it's such a crappy example for a kid. So then she was sort of laughing at me. And then I was like, no, I'm going to skate. And then like, I'm all right at skating, but I'm not excellent. I can like, yeah, I'm all right at it, but it's not like I'm never going to trip. And I tripped as soon as I got out of like the flat, the apartment block. And she sort of didn't see me out the window and then was watching and even sort of shouting at me as I skated up. But I felt like an idiot and I loved it. And if I was actually alone then, I would have loved it. But every single time an adult passed me, in my head, I thought, they think I'm an adult roller skater, therefore they think I'm a dickhead.
That's so funny. You know what? There is, again, another study that I've got in my upcoming book kind of speaks to why that is. So, because I'd never thought, like, why do I feel good doing X, but I don't, you know, don't feel okay doing Y, that's, you know, that's a bit more fun? Or, you know, why do we distinguish between activities when we're by ourselves? Because, you know, going to the supermarket or going for a run, that seems fine. But yeah, roller skating, not so much. So apparently we're okay doing what we call utilitarian things. So, you know, like just literally basic things you'd have to do, but things that are, you know, that are hedonic, that actually have that built-in fun and pleasure, because we have this perception that we should be doing fun things in groups, or that we generally would do fun things in groups, we distinguish. So we feel more self-conscious when we're by ourselves doing those fun things. That's something that they did, you know, it did a huge study of different people, and everyone did find that they were more self-conscious doing those certain activities. Which,
that's amazing and so lovely that I can now think, if I roller skate, that I'm too much of a hedonist for people to cope with it.
That's it.
I don't know if this is sort of what the study was about, but it kind of made me think about sex when you were talking about that, which I guess is another, for me, amazing thing about living alone is masturbating, just to be blunt about it. And I find it really funny being a being a parent that lives on my own, that you're allowed to basically, like heterosexual married couples around me are allowed to admit to their children that they have sex, but they still will only do that in that utilitarian way. Like, they won't admit to their kids, most of them, some of them are more open, but they won't, they still say like, oh, mummy and daddy, you know, they do this because we want to make a baby or because whatever, but this like make it, we're having sex to make a baby thing is still, it was reeled out by so many parents around me when our kids were young, and it was all right to tell your kid that sex was about making a baby, but it's not all right to tell them that it's just for pleasure with each other. And also the idea, like, I told my daughter that I masturbate basically, and one of the other parents that I told was horrified that I told her that, but I thought, this is my version of you having sex with your husband that your children are allowed to know about, but apparently it's just to make babies. But mine is like, it's a very safe thing to do. Like, it's you know, this, I think it's one of the safest, most environmentally friendly, cheap, free activities you can do alone. And that, again, bit like roller skating, but for slightly different reasons, but maybe similar-ish, has been like frowned upon for centuries and deemed a sin. And yeah, I find that really funny, because there's no point to it, obviously, other than to have a very lovely, relaxing evening, yeah, by yourself. So I guess that is completely hedonistic, and it's a pleasure, isn't it? So it's seen as more sinful than reproductive sexes.
It's so strange. I think I constantly, you know, it's that classic joke that you have with your parents, like, oh well, obviously I've got a brother, so obviously you've only ever had sex twice in your entire marriage. But I also think there's more of a stigma talking about masturbation as opposed to couples talking about their sex life. Again, there's that strange thing, okay, you can only do something fun with another person.
Yeah, totally. And also, I guess from like a parenting point of view, it's definitely seen as all right to talk about, but masturbation isn't. It's like, what do you want your kids to do first, especially with girls? Mm. Like, the timeline of most boys is that they do start masturbating before they then touch somebody else. So they get to know what they like and how to do things. But loads of girls don't. They sort of please other people before, or they're disgusted to do it, or nobody talks about it. I remember that at school with me, and it's changing, but it hasn't changed that much. It's like, what do you want your daughter to think it's all right to do first? Like, just straight into the baby sex or to masturbate. Yeah, it's quite, or it's seen as, I think sometimes it's seen as this like, well, lonely activity, which I find that really ridiculous, that it's not seen as something that you would do because you're alone and enjoy it, and it's a positive thing, which for me, oh my God, it bloody well is. But it's seen as this sort of, that's what you would do if you are single.
Yeah.
Or if you're not with your partner.
You're so right when you say that. And yet, thinking about that actual experience, what is more lonely? Being with a partner that you don't like, or, you know, a partner that doesn't care about your needs, and your relationship might be failing, or even, you know, the kind of idea of like a sexual fling, but them again not being emotionally very good for you. You know, what's more sad and lonely, having that situation or learning to pleasure yourself?
Yeah, which obviously, like, from the amount of stories about unhappy relationships you hear, it's pretty obvious which one seems to be worse. I find it strange as well, like, lots of people that I talk to, women more, who don't feel that satisfied in heterosexual relationships, I guess, or feel that they could say what they actually want, which I do think is harder for heterosexual women, sneak off to masturbate.
So it's like this secret thing that you do in a couple. And I know that's not the same with everyone, but sort of like stepping out of the house to just, oh, I'm going for a walk, and having somebody say, oh, why? Oh, are you trying to get away? Why do you want to be on your own? As if wanting to be on your own, if you're living with someone or in a couple, is like really negative. As if you want to be on your own, it means you don't want to be with them, rather than you just want to be on your own. I think those are two really, really different things. That you just want to be by yourself. It's not that you want space away, or maybe it is, but it's not necessarily. And I think the same with masturbation. I know quite a few people that sort of sneak off to do it, or I guess people that are stay-at-home parents, when everyone's out of the house, which now with lockdown isn't really possible, but that sneak away, either because they're embarrassed that they do it, or feel guilty, or because the partner sort of sees it as kind of adulterous, like you're kind of sneaking off, like why aren't they sort of good enough, or like it's so complicated. Whereas I think like masturbating is so different from being with someone. Like I think they're both brilliant, but genuinely feel like I've got two sex lives, and that even if I lived with a partner again, I'd still want to keep a bit of the one by myself. And not by myself as someone watching or doing it together, just like literally having a night by myself to try stuff that might be awkward or impossible physically with somebody else there.
Yeah. So you think that solitude plays a really important role in female sexuality, you know, in or out of a relationship?
Yeah, and I'm sure male as well, like for anyone, because we're told so much, aren't we, about like what's sexy, like, and what good sex is. Like, I've read so much crap growing up about like position of the month and best way, especially for females, I'd say, because obviously there's quite a lot of pressure in heterosexual sex for penetrative sex to be like the thing. Obviously that's been shown as like sex because that's reproductive sex, and I think it's been the only sex that's not seen as like sinful. So it's been, you know, it's got lower censorship ratings than a lot of oral sex and things like that. So I found that being alone, like having my own house for the last 5 years, obviously it's not my own, like my daughter's here, but she's not here 2 days a week. Just the amount of time that I've been able to spend, not just masturbating, like it sounds like you're just, you know, but just learning what I actually like and trying to get rid of all this stuff. Like, do you like just everything? Like, do you actually like this? Do you like being touched like this? Do you like using lube? Do you like, what are you actually thinking of when there's not a guy next to you that even if you are really comfortable with, you're still kind of trying to impress in a way that has been built into you for years? So just like letting my mind wander when I'm on my own, I guess having sex by myself, you'd probably put it, but letting my mind wander about things that actually turn me on rather than things that I've been told, and how, like, what sounds do I make when I'm in no way aware of trying to let, you know, I've read lots of articles about women should make noise so that he knows that he's doing it right, or, you know, but sometimes I don't want to be like a sat nav for somebody else. I just want to make whatever noise actually comes naturally. And I think it got to a stage where I was like, does this come naturally? Is this natural? Or am I still acting? Like, what's the line? Because there's so much that you're told that maybe is relevant and maybe isn't. But yeah. I think alone time for that. And a lot of the older women in my family, I've spoken to them so much about sex, and my grandma especially, which I didn't expect. And she didn't think like female orgasm existed. She thought it was a myth. She thought oral sex was a myth, like all this different stuff. And she said sex was the biggest disappointment of her life. And she said she just was never on her own. Like she never had a space on her own, I guess, like Virginia Woolf. Like that book, A Room of One's Own. It's like, oof, there's so many things that you need a room of your own for. I think it was a bit about masturbation, although I have not read that in a long time. But yeah, just like actually, as someone my grand's age, if you'd been told that this is sex, like this is sex, and no one had told you anything else, like how would you have known what would turn you on? It's not so physically obvious as it is for boys.
Yeah.
What to do with your body.
That's exactly it. And also, you know, to start with, I adore, and you write about this a lot in Slug, I adore that you've had these candid conversations with your grandma about sex. Yeah, I love that. It's pretty unique. And even you know, we grew up likely on these sort of cosmopolitan 10 ways to please your man, of which I do not think there's an equivalent for men. There just isn't, you know. And, you know, I like to think that's changing. I'm not sure how much that is the case. But there is so much, I suppose, to unlearn as a woman before you can enjoy your sexuality.
Or as a straight woman, I think a lot of my friends who are queer women don't really have the same issues. I don't think they've been blinded by quite so many Hollywood movies as heterosexual women, really. But yeah, it makes me really annoyed that the unlearning bit of it. It really annoys me. And I remember somebody saying to me, oh, but isn't it always like that when you're a teenager and you're sort of fumbling and you don't know what to do? And it's like, no, it's not like that. It's like 10 years without having any orgasms when you're starting your sexual thing or whatever it is for people, or a lifetime. Or I've got friends that have had their first one in their 40s now, and some people that I know have never had them. But it makes me so angry that it's just this sort of crappy education and culture which has sort of robbed you of like this free pleasure that you could get. I really find like I've been reading all the kind of historic stuff about, obviously, and boys were told it too, not just girls, but it's been more long term for girls, I think, the sort of anti-masturbation protests. It's amazing the things that, you know, science or religion claimed that it would do, like obviously blindness was a big one. And I was reading about Kellogg's, like the guy that invented cornflakes, but that's in the book. I was reading about it, and he invented cornflakes as an anti-masturbation cereal because he thought like spicy foods and flavored foods were really sinful, so they resulted in like pleasure, which was sinful. So cornflakes was actually invented as a food, like so bland that it would be like an anti-sexual food. It's amazing. His history, and he was really against sex and he was really against masturbation, and he invented like cages to put children in if they couldn't stop masturbating. This is John Kellogg's, one of the brothers, the other one didn't. He was really pro like clitoral burning, and these sort of contraptions to put on boys' penises to stop them masturbating. Like, there's been a lot historically against this alone act. But I think that it fascinates me because I get the religious stuff about pleasure being sinful. Like, that's quite hard to argue against sort of ardent people that do believe that sort of thing. But just the fact that it's, you know, we still don't really talk about it in sex education so much, like it's getting in there, but it's really safe. Like, of all the sexual acts that you can do, masturbation is like, it's so safe. Like, you can't, there's no STDs, there's no, you know, fear of pregnancy, there's no fear that this person might actually not be a very nice person, there's no emotional trauma, it's free, it's like good for the environment. It's just amazing that this thing that actually can bring you so much pleasure and has no negative side effects, really, has been demonized for like centuries. So, like, in Victorian times, I was reading that they told parents that they shouldn't let little girls go on rocking horses because it was too like stimulating in that sort of way. And obviously they should side saddle horses and then side saddle bikes. Yeah. Because you're opening your legs, so it's like too sexual and it's manly. But yeah, for the rocking horses for the little girls was because it was, yeah, it could be deemed too sort of sexually stimulating. That's why I like cycling.
No, it literally comes full circle.
Yeah. Back to the cycling.
Oh yeah, we've sniffed her out now.
But yeah, so I really find it all really, really fascinating.
And it's so powerful when you actually address it, when you actually think, you know, all this that we internalize, that, you know, I think we're all, you know, however progressive we are, we're all still unpacking things every day. Of course, you know, why aren't people taught in sex education that, you know, masturbation is not only okay, it's also, you know, such a good thing to do. And it's also so, instead of being shrouded in shame, it's actually entirely guilt-free.
Yeah, entirely guilt-free, but it's talked about as if it's like the sort of the worst thing. I just think of like sex education lessons at school. We put like condoms on a carrot and that was it, really. So the safe side of sex was just making a penis safe to put in us, basically.
Yeah.
That was it. It was as if that is the safest that sex can get. Which is bollocks. That's like the second least safe that sex can get.
Quite literally. That's a very good point. I love it. There's a part of the book, actually, that this really speaks to. It's a poem called Show Face. And you talk about the the difference between the face that you make when you masturbate alone and the face that you try to make.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ache when it's turning someone on. And it just, yeah. I think it so speaks to the idea of like almost performative versus just enjoying yourself.
I think so. Do you know, I've got to say, and I don't know if I should say this on a podcast, I feel like I share quite a lot in the book, but I still do not share very, very, very personal stuff. But I actually wrote that poem. I was talking to one of my friends, Kat, about it. And we were just talking about that. But we started the conversation because I'd basically been masturbating at home. And at one point sort of just stopped, you know, when you have that sort of out of body thing and think, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing? And I was, I was really sort of, it was quite cold in my house, but I wanted to be warm. So I like sat next to the radiator to do it. And then I really liked the feel of the radiator, like on my breast, basically. So then at one point I sort of stopped. This is not my normal like position to masturbate in, but I was like, Holly, you're literally crouched on your floor with your nipples like against the radiator and then off it because it's getting a bit hot. So this is the opposite of what I've seen on every film. If they ever have anything about female masturbation, you're always like, you know, your face looks really nice, you're still pouting, your hair's brushed. And I thought, fuck. And then my friend, well, I won't tell her thing, but we were just talking about how sometimes if you sort of not so much in the mood, that is not that easy to have an orgasm, but you're like, I am going to get there. Like sometimes it is very easy and sometimes it's like, all right, I'm gonna get there. I'm not stopping this. And the sort of face or positions or whatever you might get into for that. So yeah, that was dedicated to me leaning against the radiator.
I mean, and I think you do actually, I think the poem, if I remember correctly, is also two cats, I believe, or four
yeah.
cats.
At the yeah, end. Four cats.
Beautiful dedication.
Yeah. And I think that's, yeah. But yeah, the idea that you, if I said like, I went on holiday with my partner, but I still went and like masturbated once or twice, I think. And somebody was like, oh yeah, so that he could watch. It's like, well, if he wants to, but not really. Like, that's totally different. That's not the same. In fact, that's probably the opposite for me. I'd rather like be interactive with someone than somebody just watch me masturbate. Like, that's probably gonna make me very much more self-conscious than just to be on show. I feel like I've been told all my life that I should be very comfortable as a female being on show, like walking around in sexy underwear. I should be really comfortable with that, or like dancing for a man, or all the other stuff that you're sort of shown that you should be comfortable doing. Or not even that I'm not comfortable, I just don't enjoy it that much. I'd much rather, yeah, squash my boobs up to the radiator and...
But it's that permission, isn't it? It's that permission to be unsexy, to be that pure, like, authentic self that you are, and actually just yeah. focus on your own pleasure.
Yeah, I think I'd be all right with it if I didn't have all these like Hollywood images in my head. I just need to get them out. That's what I love about being alone as well, like sexually in that way. Because sometimes I think this has happened definitely in the last few years. Like, stuff has come into my head, which I would probably refuse to admit that I found sexy, because I've actually let myself, like, my brain just go off on whatever tangent it wants. And sometimes obviously things come into your head that will really put you off, and it's like, oh, for fuck's sake, why have I started thinking about that? But I found it really interesting, the sort of things that actually come into my head that I feel sexy about. And sometimes my brain is like, no, Holly, you honestly don't find that sexy. But my like body is like, I'm afraid you do. That's the problem. But yeah, it's why it's so safe, I guess. You can sort of do what you want.
It is, yeah. And again, it's that the benefit of alone time to sort of just, yeah, discover yourself without anyone judging, or, you know, worrying how you're going to look to other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted the idea of sort of also, you know, in the book, you talk a lot about women not being able to ask for what they want. There's a particular poem where you discuss, you know, that idea of just not being able to communicate as a woman your needs to a man, and you know, it's seeming like this mystic thing, and so, you know, you never actually end up saying it, and I think that idea as well of being afraid to ask what you want,
yeah.
Also, it's quite a lonely experience, I think.
Yeah, I think it is. And that was like the first boy that must have been in my late teens, that actually said, like, is that right? Do you like it? Like, what do you like? And I know there's been stuff like that in like the program Sex Education, where the guy said to one of the characters, are you actually enjoying this? Like, what do you actually like? And she's never thought about it before. But there are so many hurdles, I think, often in saying to a guy who's had the same shitty sex education as well. Like, I put up a post about this online the other day, and I had loads of replies which were way worse than any experience that I've had with guys. Mainly the guys that I've been with have wanted to know what I like. And at first, I guess I couldn't say, because I didn't have a clue myself for a while. I like the reverse cowgirl. Like, do you Holly, or did you read that in More magazine as well? Like, do you actually like it, or have you explored that thought? But yeah, I remember thinking, oh right, he wants to know if it's right, and it's not like, I think he was like poking his finger or doing that thing where everything has to simulate penetrative sex, you know. Whatever they're doing. And but I thought, like, I don't know if the way that I masturbate is the way that my friends masturbate, because we don't talk about it. And physically, I do think it's so different, because it's really not like something suddenly pops up and says, I know it's not that simple for guys learning to wank, but it's a bit more obvious, I think,
the end point is maybe more obvious, or the end point in that sort of way. Just where to touch is more obvious. You see more pictures of penises, like you hear more about erections, whereas with girls, there's like nothing. And we don't really see other vulvas, especially as a heterosexual woman. So it's not like you've had loads of experience even seeing that anatomy. I find it hard to say the word vulva and labia, but I'm trying to pretend that I don't. So I remember thinking, like, what if I tell this guy to do things that I like? And that is nothing like how other girls do it. And then he thinks I'm weird. And also, like, the girls at school, I had one friend that admitted that she masturbated and she was immediately deemed a slag. And my boyfriend was saying this as well. He was saying he remembers still the girl at school that told everyone that she did wank. And all the guys were like, oh, she's up for it.
Wow. Yeah, that made her a slag.
Yeah, that made her a slag because she touched her own body, or it made her like she really wants sex now. Or it made her weird with the other girls. Yeah. They were like horrible to her. It made her weird. I thought, God.
Yeah, it's so bonkers because it's paradoxical, isn't it?
It is. It's wrong. And I don't think like most, there was a study that I was asked to read when I did an advert for a condom company. And it was about all these sort of things, basically the like, orgasm gap in heterosexual relationships and how hard it is often to speak about what you like or to know what you like sometimes. But whatever the research was, found that like 90% of people in couples want to know. So it's not like people don't want to please their partner. Obviously like 10% of them didn't seem to mind. But then whenever I put stuff online and whenever I talk to my friends about it, especially people that have dated a few different men, they have some really like horrendous stories, which are obviously like defensive from the guy's point of view, I think. So it's not like, oh, what a dick. In my head, it's not like, oh God, he's a bastard. But like a lot of people have said things like they've said to a guy, it's mainly about penetrative sex, which I love when I'm turned on, but which does very little if I'm not turned on. So I think that's what I've realized. There's lots of stuff about, oh, this isn't any good. But I do love it, but I didn't love it when I was having it when I was younger, because that was it. And in that case, it was like nothing for me. And for most women, that's not what is the main thing that's going to make you orgasm or feel a lot of pleasure, but it's obviously the main thing that we see in the culture. But when women had tried to say this to the guys that they were dating, a lot of them had basically acted like she was weird. Like a lot of women I spoke to, women in their 50s even, hadn't realized, had just thought they weren't very sexual, which I think is the same with my grandma. She just said, oh, women don't really like sex that much. But all she was having was like penetrative sex with nothing like around it at all. So yeah, that sort of not knowing what a guy's reaction is going to be. And then also feeling like, so I either have to stand up for myself that actually this is very normal. And even if it wasn't, like even if what turns you on isn't the norm, that should also be all right for like a lover, a romantic partner. But for younger girls and less confident people, that is just, it's horrendous to think, I don't know if this is normal. And then also if I do tell you, it still might not work the way that, you know, it still might take longer than you see definitely on screen. I think the length of time that women take to come in Hollywood, people talk about porn a lot, and I know there are horrendous sides to porn, which I'm very against, but I also think like romantic comedies and stuff do nothing for for the way that we see sex. The length of time it takes, that sort of pressure that people feel to be quicker. So I think female organs sort of treat like rocket science, whereas I think most women, when they're on their own, are very capable of easily having an orgasm, yeah. Basically.
It creates a sort of loneliness in that, you know, in not talking about it. Because, for instance, you know, the example of the girl at school, you said he was called a slag because she said that she masturbated. And, you know, and if women aren't, I, you know, from my own experience, I think I was way more likely to trade like sex tips with my friends, you know, when we were first having sex or first exploring that, than I was to ever, you know, admit to one another that we masturbated. You know, that was, yeah, it was so too. Much more a thing. Yeah. Which is completely bonkers. And it makes, again, it creates a loneliness around one experience of masturbation. And yet, you know, and you're only allowed to connect around kind of, you know, sex with other people.
Yeah. And also it's such a positive thing, I think. Like now, I think as a female, I feel like I've got all these different sort of ways to have pleasure. Like one of which is penetration. It's very cool. Like when you're enjoying it, like it's a very cool addition. It's just not, doesn't have to be like the entire thing, obviously, which you're taught it is.
But I, you know, I like what you say about sort of learning to masturbate and learning to, well, obviously having a sexual relationship with a partner and doing both of them. It's simply, it's multiple ways to gain pleasure. And I think often that's how I sort of defend any type of alone time, because I think the minute there is that stigma, the minute people think, oh, you've learned to enjoy yourself alone in any respect, they think, oh, well, you don't need other people. And it immediately becomes something that's sort of, yeah, that immediately people go on the defensive, or they think, yeah, oh, you're just this hermit. And, you know, actually it's that, it's, you know, with any type of alone time, it's that knowing that these experiences can be both pleasurable and equally valid.
Yeah. Also, I think it's, I don't mean jealousy in general for somebody else's life, but I do think there's a hell of a lot of people who feel really lonely with a partner, or really lonely, overwhelmed with a family, not because they don't love their partner or their children, but just because all their alone time has basically been taken. Like the guilt that I see some friends feel just to go out by themselves away from their child or children or husband or wife or partner or whatever, it's really overwhelming, actually. And I think it, the idea that like, oh, well, you're sort of, I feel a bit like the in the village I'm in, there's not many parents living on their own, and you feel like a bit of a sort of like rolled out as the example and sort of laughed at a bit. But also my house is always used for people to like gather in, because it doesn't have a man in it, or it doesn't have a partner in it. So I think there's the idea that when you sort of want a bit of something, you are also a bit of a bitch to people that have it, a bit of jealousy. And I'm not saying they would want to not live with their partner, or they want a divorce, or they want to split up. I don't mean that. But the, like, just the extent that alone time is taken away often when you become a parent or move in with a partner, I think it's really bad. And I think it really affects people a lot. Like a lot of people I see are just so desperate to just get some space, but it's seen as a really negative thing, because it's seen as wanting to get away from people rather than just wanting to be with yourself.
Yeah, which is crazy, because, you know, it's an experience that everyone can benefit from, having that alone time. I think there's almost, I don't know, and do you think there's almost a sense that people aren't, as you say, like allowed to want that alone time? Because, you know, it's understood, for instance, that, you know, it, society thinks that if you're single, you want to be in a relationship. It's that classic Jane Austen, you know, every man in with a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Yeah. Well, if you're single, you want to be in a relationship. But where are all the jokes? Like, where are the comedians standing up? All I hear from sort of, I watch so much stand-up comedy. I love it. But there are so many married comedians that make jokes about how much they hate being married. Like, it seems to be like a standard joke, and I'm so bored of it. I'm just so over it. It's like, oh, but is it a joke? Like, because it's quite sad, because I see people in this sort of relationship a lot, and it seems really horrible. There's a lot of joke, you know, they're sort of husband and wife, mainly for married. It doesn't seem to happen so much when people aren't married, I don't know. But that sort of, I don't know, that sort of loving joke, it's hard to know the balance, the loving joke about, oh, the wife, or oh, she's doing this, or oh, he's doing this. Oh, is it a joke though, or are there just lots of people that are sort of desperately lonely in their relationships? I'm not really sure. Or at least to get, like, I guess, as saying at the beginning, co-parenting,
like for the last 4 years, 5 years, I've had 2 days a week alone. And as a parent, that's not normal at all, I don't think. But the idea that I would in any way celebrate that or put anything about it online in any posts, I know I'd get so much shit for it. First of all, I guess from people that think it's like bad in a mothering way, like you want time on your own, as if you like hate your child because you also like having time on your own. And then also from people that really want some time on your own, and it's like you're shoving it in their face. But I think in that way, there's certain things that if you are in a happy relationship, you know, and you want to be in that relationship, but you still want to get time alone, I don't know, I'm sure there's got to be another way for like once a week. I know some couples that once a week is like Saturday night is his, Sunday night is hers, or whatever. They do it like that. And I think it's really healthy because I think it's made a bloody massive difference to my life having time away from my kid. Well, it's not even time away from my kid, it's just time by myself.
Yeah, I think it's perfectly valid to say. And, you know, I think if you know, couples could introduce some element of that co-parenting dynamic, if you found it useful, then I'm sure that many parents would also find it useful to do that.
I'm sure they would, but there seems to just be a guilt. Like half of my friends haven't had a night away from their kids in like 4 years. And I don't know how I would have coped. I just don't know how I would have coped with that. Maybe I'm just the worst parent. That's saying all stuff. I genuinely don't think I am. Yeah, it's just, it is interesting, isn't it? How the people I know often that are the most lonely are the ones that don't live alone.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like it changes a lot when you're forced to live alone. Like my grandma, for example, was very lonely a lot of the time because she didn't really choose to live alone. It just obviously happened when my granddad died and she was on her own. But with lots of family still going to see her, but still felt very lonely. But I do find it interesting how, you know, younger people who whatever age that do choose to live alone is sort of still seen as this saddest, depressing state of affairs. And I definitely the loneliest I think I've ever felt is definitely being in crowds of people. I asked my daughter this actually. I gave her like a fake podcast interview when we were eating waffles over breakfast and asked her when she felt lonely, and she said the same thing. She was like, oh, I feel most lonely when I'm like in a group of friends and they're being mean or they're ignoring me. And I thought, God, me too. That's the same. I feel most lonely. I feel most lonely at awkward parties that I don't want to be at, or like a publishing party I had to go to once and read like one poem and then you're meant to mingle. Anywhere where you have to stand up as an adult with a glass of wine in your hand and mingle. I think that's my loneliest moment. Can't stand it. And then I went and hid in the toilets. That's when my last book was released. I was reading a poem. It was like a Picador publishing party. And I thought, I'm not in this world. Like, I don't know what to say to people. And I walked around for a bit randomly with this glass of wine in my hand. I thought if I just get uncomfortable, I could easily just down these and then that'd be ridiculous because I've got to go home on my own. And then that's quite stupid to just be hammered when you're going home. So I just went and hid in the toilets and texted my mum. She was like, Holly, you need to stop hiding in the toilets at parties that you feel awkward in. But I felt much better sitting on my own in the toilet than I did just wandering around in this like very sort of, sort of posher atmosphere that I'm used to, or just more serious, or and people making conversation with you and I don't really care. Like it's all a bit fake. That sort of atmosphere, I think that's definitely my loneliest setting.
Sort of like performative conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I suspect, you know, being around those people and not sort of getting the connection that you want, I suppose the more people there not giving you that connection, the lonelier you can feel.
Yeah, and I know it's like partly me, because I'm sure the people are lovely. So I try not to be that judgmental and think, oh, listen to that person. What else? Yeah, I don't know what it is. I'm sure lots of people feel like that. These sort of mingling things, they're a nightmare for a lot of people. I think I'm sort of done with like polite conversations. I've really had enough of them. And I feel, as much as I like a lot on Radio 4, I feel the same about some of the sort of Radio 4 comedy dramas, that sort of polite comedy or old fashioned polite comedy. Oh, I'm just done with. I feel like all the stuff that we don't talk about is the stuff that's actually affecting people, I guess, like sexual things or masturbation and just sort of standing around at that kind of dinner party. It's not the atmosphere I was brought up in either. But it's also so fakely polite. Like, I think I find that annoying about adults. And I think that kind of, sometimes it's good, obviously, not wanting to say what you think all the time. And I don't really want people to tell me what they think of me all the time. But yeah, that sort of making conversation. Oh, where do you work? Oh, what do you do? It's like, but no one cares. So what are we doing? Like, and just being polite and having to watch what I say about stuff. And I guess as well from writing about a lot to do with sexual things or taboos, and being in circles often in more of the sort of poetry world, I guess, and with my mates, where we really do just talk about all of that stuff, and then suddenly being back into the society and remembering, like, oh, I forgot that this is deemed vulgar and this is deemed rude and this is off limits and so many things that you're not allowed to talk about, which are mainly the more interesting parts of life, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It reminds me, I saw a video that you did a couple of years ago about loneliness online. You said being afraid to ask for what you want, that is often the source of loneliness. And you said that children have the edge with that because children often feel able to ask for what they want, you know, that affection from their friends and that physical touch.
Yeah.
Whereas adults don't. And that is what creates the loneliness sometimes.
Interesting. I don't remember saying that, but I do agree with it, which would make sense if I said it. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I guess I feel like as an adult, there's so many rules and there's so many things that are off limit, which obviously in a way is good. Like kids, I think, are often happier, but they're also selfish little gits sometimes. So do you know what I mean? Like, I think adults care more about other people, which is why we just don't go around like demanding ice cream from people who've invited us around for a cup of tea or whatever. But yeah, there are a lot of roles of things that you can and can't do and ask people for. I think that kind of touching one for me, I know not everybody likes to be touched, but I think we're very untouchy-feely now as a society because it's, you know, we, our boundaries between, is that a bit sexual or is that not? We're very messed up about all that stuff in our culture. We think we're so forward about it, but I don't think we are, apart from maybe, yeah, people in the kink community that I've met that seem to actually be able to talk about anything, which is amazing to me. But yeah, like my daughter, when they're allowed to have friends over, they'd come over and just say, shall we brush each other's hair? Or shall we, you know, play dogs or like stuff that I can do with my daughter is really fun. I know people struggle with their kids, but I really like hanging out with my child a lot of the time. But then if I hang out with an adult, often it's like, okay, so you can invite that person around to drink tea, or you can invite them out for dinner, or you could go for a walk. But again, there's just rules that kids don't have. I think there's so much talking in adulthood as well, like so much. And it's so not like, I've got one friend that I like go to swimming pool with, and it's amazing. And she's really like loves diving, and not like very seriously, but loves like bombing in the pool and stuff. Like, I love swimming, but I don't love actually swimming. I like diving and bombing and splashing in the pool and swimming a bit and going under the water. But again, that's not really what you go for. You have to swim now as an adult and just, you know, do breaststroke and chat as you go up and down. Like, I don't know who chose that adulthood, like to be an adult, it just meant you had to do more boring things. I don't know where that rule started. But yeah, they're much more tactile, kids are, with each other. And I do have I wrote about it. I wrote this poem called Mother Me about how I do all this stuff for my daughter and I'd love someone to do it for me. Like, even just wrapping you in a towel or combing your hair. But when you're an adult, if you ask someone to do that, it's like a, seen as like a sexual thing more, any touch. So it's really like different. But then my boyfriend saw the poem and he was like, I'll do it.
Oh,
that's like, okay, that would be excellent, actually. Yeah.
but that's lovely, because I think that, you know, again, as you say, you know, you talk a lot as an adult, and that's wonderful, but it is only one way to connect. And I think especially, you know, with the past year of many lockdowns and restrictions, and you know the idea of like touch deprivation that we've very much started talking about a lot more, we realized that as lovely as it is to be able to connect and to talk over Zoom in the way that we might have before, there is still a loneliness in not having touch.
Oh yeah, totally. And I felt that, like, it's a bit of a morbid thing to say, but my gran died during the first lockdown.
I'm so sorry.
And so, oh thanks. Yeah, she was really brilliant, and I was really close to her in the family, and obviously couldn't go to the funeral, as was like right at the beginning of the book. It feels funny sometimes when I talk about things that actually happened in my life, but now I've put them in a book, so now it sort of feels like it's not true in a way. I don't know if you get that, but sometimes I do. But yeah, so I couldn't get to the funeral, and I really thought it would be okay because I could watch it, and I thought it would be really nice to be alone, because funerals aren't the best in my head, not the nicest things to go to. And I genuinely did think I'd be all right. And then I thought, maybe this would be better because I can just cry and no one's watching me. And my daughter was at her dad so that I could watch it. She didn't want to watch it. But the worst bit of it, I watched all the speech and everything, and that was fine. But the worst bit of it was when everyone got up and I could see my mum and my auntie and my cousin, Nikki. And I'm really close to all of them. And they got up and I just really wanted to like see their face, not on a screen. And I quite like the Zooms, and I do a lot of Zooms with like my schoolmates and mates from uni and stuff, like quite a lot, or like talking to friends' kids to occupy them for a bit so they can go off and do stuff. And there's a lot of friend Zooms going on. And I've spoken to my friends more during lockdown than I did before, in a lot of situations where I can't actually see them anyway. But at the funeral, just like, this is just this is dreadful now, being on my own. It's totally crap. And I just thought, it wasn't even just the touch, it wasn't even like the hug, it was just seeing someone in 3D that I really wanted. And it was obviously in the heaviest lockdown where I'd hardly seen anyone at all. But yeah, and I feel, not that it's the same, but I've been doing online gigs, and obviously after like an actual live gig, which I don't really enjoy doing the live gigs that much because it's so nerve-wracking, so it's been nice to do them online and not be like feeling like I'm going to be sick before I read some poems to people. But it's really weird afterwards, because you read all the comments and I feel like I'm really interacting with people afterwards, and like answering some questions and stuff, and whatever, you see emojis popping up, it's not quite the same. But but then putting that off and turning around in my house, it's like, oof, it's so quiet. Like normally I'd maybe be going to a hotel room on my own sometimes, but often my partner comes to the gigs, or my daughter, or I go to a pub with people after. And that was, I was sort of trying to get my head around if I actually liked it more or less. It's like, do I prefer doing these gigs on my own and then just being able to go to bed, or do I really want to go to a bar now with people that I don't know and chat to them? Not really sure. I guess it depends on the day.
It does, yeah. And I guess it's identifying what about those situations makes them positive or not.
Yeah it's odd, isn't it?
Yeah. And what's your writing process? So you know, I want to talk about alonement, what that looks like for you. I know we've spoken quite a bit about the joy of alone time earlier in the podcast, from roller skating to masturbation, I think we covered quite a lot of ground, but I want to talk a little bit more about what alonement looks like for you as a creative person. You know, what's your writing process like? Is solitude important to you in that respect?
Yeah, it is. But I often write in very different places, I think. So obviously at the moment there's a lot less time to actually work, having my daughter off school, but I never sit down to write, really, ever, I don't think. So I never really, I don't write most of my poems and stuff at my desk. I've never really written poems from a kind of learning how to write poems. I've never studied poetry in terms of you know, at uni, and your task now is to write a poem. So I don't really know how to do it like that. So I'll just write when I've got an idea in my head normally, which can be anywhere, which I guess, as much as they're rubbish for a lot of reasons, I really like mobile phones. Also for the being able to walk alone without totally thinking I'm going to be murdered, I really like having a mobile phone. So I will take it everywhere with me. So yeah, it is important, but I think I write quite a lot. I don't know, like if I'm walking around the park and my daughter's playing with her friends on the swings, or if I'm sitting on the train, is amazing for me for writing, I guess, because it's not pressure. Like if I just sit at my desk and I'm totally on my own, I don't know if that's the best time for me to write, really. If I'm moving, if there's stuff happening and on trains and things, not saying never. I often write in my bed, and I normally write at night. So I think, yeah, maybe it is, but it's not really in work hours, I guess, that I write. That's where I do all the admin a lot of the time, unless something pops in my head. But in my bed at night when my daughter's asleep, I often want to write then, because I know that if I do get into a sort of, I don't know, what would you say, a groove, although I don't think I've ever used that word before, into the groove, then I do know that there is 9 hours in front of me that, yeah, I could possibly carry on, which happens a lot, even though that means that you're then up till 4 in the morning. I don't really mind that at the moment. Not having to do the school run is quite helpful for me, being able to work like very late at night. So that sort of silence is very helpful. But it's normally writing, it's normally after I've listened to stuff. It's normally other people. So not really alone time that helps me to write. It's being around other people or reading somebody else's book or watching something that gives me ideas for writing.
That's interesting. So it's kind of that connection that then sparks your sort of independent thoughts.
Yeah, I think so. Not always. Like sometimes I'll be sitting at the window, and I do watch the birds a lot out the window, and then I'll want to write something about them. But I don't think I'm a Wordsworthy type of writer. Not that I know much about him, but that there's quite a lot of writing retreats that you go on, and the whole point of it is to be alone. But which they're not very suitable for parents, which is quite annoying still. Yeah. But so a lot of writers I know have gone for like a month, 2 months even. But most of those places, I've been invited to some of them. But they all seem to be in very rural areas. Like I've taught at a couple. And for some people, that's amazing, obviously, getting away from everything and totally having time alone. And that's the whole point. And you go and do writing exercises and sit in these beautiful places like tiny cottages in the Scottish Highlands or wherever it is. But I went to one for like a week and I was teaching. But then you got some time and the teacher's bits were sort of a bit away in this other cottage. And again, that fear came back. Like, I don't feel that, creative sitting in the Yorkshire moors on my own in a cottage, like not knowing what's around me. I think I find it like sometimes beautiful, but then also I'm sort of on edge a wee bit. So I think if somebody wanted to give me a great writing retreat, it would be maybe on the fourth story of a hotel in Manchester, that I could sit at the window and watch people go down to the bar and have a drink full of people, go back up and sit at a desk in a place where there's a receptionist and I feel really safe and secure and I can like see the world. But I like seeing people, I think, to write. Yeah, but you don't really get many poetry writing retreats in cities, basically.
Hey, I think there's something very nice about the sort of almost sterility of a hotel room. It's like a blank slate, isn't it?
Yeah, like I love them. I'm a much better writer in a hotel room than in a cottage in the Highlands, I think.
But I think it's so I think it's so important to I love that you're so honest about your writing process, and I love that, you know, you kind of say, look, it's okay, I you know, I write a lot on my iPhone. You know, I know that on your Instagram you quite often share like iPhone notes in the notes app of poems you've written, and it shows, you know, you don't have, it doesn't have to look a certain way. And even if, you know, I think that, you know, talking about you talking about sitting up late at night and, you know, writing in your bed until 4 a.m, maybe that looks a bit more, you know, what one might imagine would be typical, but I think there's all sorts of ways, and you very much have your own way of doing it, even if it's in those snatched moments of, you know, your daughter's playing in the park or you're on the train.
Yeah, I honestly couldn't think of anything worse than like writing in like a writing shed, as people call them, at the end of a garden. I would just constantly be looking around to see if anyone was trying to get in. Yeah, I think there's such, but there's, that's like everything, isn't it? It's such a romanticized idea of writers, I think, and where you're doing it. And it's often in the wilderness or cottages or, but I think that's also quite male, I guess.
I think it is, yeah. I think, I mean, the whole, like, and this is why with alonement, it's really important to me with alonement to have different sort of aspirational figures of aloneness. Because, you know, I think we talk about, yeah, Henry Thoreau going off to the woods to write, you know, his novel. And there's that notion that that's the only way that you can be alone, and that's the only valid way of being alone. And so, you know, for you to be able to say, look, obviously alone time does play into your creation, like it does play into your poetry and your writing, but you know, that can look like a moment away from your daughter in the park, or that can look like writing in your bed at night.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I honestly feel like I would have written a lot more if I had more time. Like, I do get frustrated not having enough time to write, just because there's lots of ideas I have in my head, like with a lot of people, of things I'd like to. And sometimes I get sort of jealous of the sort of carefree, wealthier section of society who can. And sometimes I get very annoyed with how much we praise writers who have had all the time in the world to write, because I think, oof, if I had that, I'd have written like much more. But yeah, I think it's also quite capitalist, isn't it, really? Or like sort of extreme capitalist, that we're constantly told that in order to do something, we have to go somewhere, buy something, wear something specific, you know, have a lovely looking writing desk, have a spare room, which is our office, have a shed in the garden. Like, we just want to make people feel like they can't, you know, can't go out for a run without buying a new Lycra jogging outfit. That seems to be the thing at the moment. And to sort of sell this idea that you can't just do stuff, you've got to buy something in order to do it. Even the sort of, I think female pleasure is being picked up by that a lot. I think sex toys and stuff are amazing in a lot of ways, but I feel like, are we just starting to talk about female orgasms and masturbations a lot now because there are so many more industries trying to sell stuff? Or are they doing it because we're talking about it more? It's hard to know. But I feel like that a bit about the writing process, like, oh, I need to book a week in Dorset in order to write this book, you know, and therefore if you can't book a week in Dorset, then you probably can't be a writer, that sort of thing. And that's something weirdly I've liked about the lockdown with my daughter especially, is that I've realized that every single activity that we've done in the like 2 hours where she's between work and like speaking to friends or whatever on the phone or on the internet, it's just been free. Like, we've just been walking or skating or cycling or whatever, going on like out to the back and climbing trees. It's all been free. So no one's really been able to sell me stuff like to do, because I can't go anywhere anyway. And that's been quite nice to realize that.
Yeah. I suppose, yeah, it feels real, doesn't it?
Yeah, a wee bit. Don't get me wrong, I'm really looking forward to going back to the trampoline park. That's another thing. I love trampolining. love it. It's like possibly my favorite thing to do for fun. And I love going to the trampoline park in Glasgow with my daughter. But then once we went to this trampoline park, we're meant to be there for about 2 hours. We stay, and it's got massive like foam pits that you can do stuff in. That's a weird thing to say, that you can bounce into. But she made a friend like one time we went, and I was like, okay, yeah, cool, go off with your friend. And then I realized I was alone. Trampoline and alone. And I love it. Like I love doing flips. I love practicing all this different stuff. But I was like, Holly, you've got to do this. You love it. Like, your daughter's not even trampolining with you. She's just next to you. Like, come on. It's like being a child again, like taking your mum's hand away. It's like, Holly, you can do this on your own. You can bounce. So what if the other parents think you're a dick?
Oh,
doesn't matter.
I think, you know what, if there's an overriding theme of this episode, I think it's being, you can do fun things alone.
I know, or with another adult. Like, fuck what people think, man.
Yeah.
Just bloody do it.
Yeah. Anyone listening to the, you know, go off trampolining, masturbate, roller skate, all of these things.
It's like bullying, isn't it? People are going to pick something else if you don't do it anyway to tease you about. So just do the stuff that you like.
Oh, well, this has been the longest podcast episode of the series, and because I just could not stop speaking to you. Oh, thank you so much for your time.
That's all right.
And all your insights.
Oh, well, you too. I can't wait to read your book. It sounds amazing. It's going to make me feel much better about the roller skating. I can feel it already.
Oh, bless you. I will definitely get you sent over a copy. Yeah. Oh, thank you so much, Holly.
That's all right. It's lovely. I'll go and make my daughter some cake now to thank her for.
Oh, bless you. That potato waffle bribe you gave her at the start of the episode, really.
That was good.
Really paid off, very, yeah. Definitely deserves that cake. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Alonement Podcast. If you'd like to learn more about alonement, my book, Alonement, How to Be Alone and Absolutely Own It, is now available to order online on Amazon, Waterstones, WH Smith, Foyles, Blackwells, and just about any good bookseller's website. As ever, do consider sharing this episode with a friend or family member that you think might benefit from hearing this conversation. Until next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.